Is Peter Massey here tonight, today, and his wife? Are you here, Peter? Would you stand, please? We forgot to have you stand. This is Brother and Sister Peter Massey, and we're thankful for your being with us. We had a good meeting. I think it's one of the best meetings I've ever attended. I believe Jimmy did his... You know, the home, like so many other, in fact, like all other institutions or situations that involve people, the home isn't any different from those in so many respects. And in this particular respect, it's no different in that in all of these situations that involve people, somebody has to be in the position of highest authority. There's got to be someone take that position if there's to be order and peace. Now, if you want chaos and confusion, then it's not necessary that anyone be in the highest place of authority. But in the classroom, this place of authority is occupied by the teacher. On the athletic field, it's occupied by the coach. In the store, it's occupied by the manager. In the bank, it's occupied by the president. And before any of you would like to suggest that the government of the United States is an example where the president can be outvoted, may I remind you that the family and the home, the family is not a democracy. It's not a place where each member of the family has equal voice and equal vote. We might not like that arrangement, but that's God's arrangement. Nor is there an arrangement where there is a revolving headship. The husband doesn't make the decisions for 2 years and then the wife make them for the next 2 years. I think I've told you when we were first married, after about 2 years, my wife met me at the front door one day with her hands on her hips and she said, "All right, you've been making the decisions for the last 2 years, now it's my time." Bless her heart, she didn't understand the arrangement of the wife in the home. I didn't understand the place that the husband fills in the home because, to my shame, and it's the only time I ever have, but I struck her on that occasion. And I am ashamed of it, and I say it simply to say I didn't understand that a husband never, ever abuses his own wife. He never, ever hates his own flesh. She didn't understand her place. I didn't understand my place. And because of that, confusion came. And the moment that we understood each one, his and her function, then we understood God's arrangement and peace and tranquility came to our home. 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter, verses 3 through 16. I want you to turn there, please. That'll be our study for the morning. 1 Corinthians 11, 3 through 16, speaks of this divine arrangement. And I'm going to read it and then we're going to single out one verse for our particular attention. We'll make reference to other verses in it, but we want to take just that one verse for our attention this morning. Beginning in verse 3 of 1 Corinthians 11, "But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ. The head of a woman is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Any man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But any woman who prays or prophesies with her head unveiled dishonors her head. It is the same as if her head were shaven. For if a woman will not veil herself, then she should cut off her hair. But if it is disgraceful for a woman to be shorn or shaven, let her wear a veil. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But woman is the glory of man. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. That's why a woman ought to have a veil on her head, because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God. Judge for yourselves, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach you that for a man to wear long hair is degrading to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her pride, for her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is disposed to be contentious, We recognize no other practice, nor do the churches of God. Now, there are some very interesting subjects introduced in this passage of Scripture. The subject of the covering of the woman, both the natural, divinely ordained covering of her long hair, that's in verse 15, and what we might call the unnatural, man-imposed covering that custom imposed upon woman, that of a veil that covered all of her face, not only the back part of her head, but it covered everything but her eyes. And in Arab countries, it covered everything but one eye. Everything but one eye was covered, and all that was for so she could get around. But that was imposed as a custom by man. But that's one of the important subjects. We're not going to talk about it today. We may discuss some of these things in the feedback class, and if you want to come there, we'll bring them up, but we won't get to it today. Another question that's brought up in this passage is the subject of the angels. Because of the angels, she ought to have her head covered. What does that mean? And then the reference to where a man that has long hair, it's a disgrace to him. It is degrading for a man to have long hair. These are all subjects that the Apostle Paul brings up in this passage of Scripture. And it seems that these people were obeying these traditions. He calls them traditions in the sense of things that had been delivered to them to observe. In verse 2, he says, I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I have delivered them to you. So it seems that they were keeping these things, and there was no problem particularly in many of the things that he was talking about. But he goes on and says, I want you to understand what you're doing. In verse 3, he says, but I want you to understand. Now, he says you're doing these things, but I want you to understand, and perhaps what he means is I want you to understand why you're doing them. And that's always honorable, not only to bind things upon people, but to give them the benefit of understanding why they're doing certain things. Now, whether this I want you to understand has reference to a broader context that is summed up really in chapter 10 and verse 31, so whatever, or whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. And that, of course, expands itself all through the entire book of 1 Corinthians. I think perhaps 1 Corinthians could be centered into one verse, and it's 1 Corinthians 10:31, that whatever we do, whether we eat or drink or whatever we do, it ought all to be done to the glory of God. And whether Paul is referring to that and saying, now I want to tell you why it is essential that we do everything to the glory of God. And he goes on then and begins to discuss this problem or to discuss this principle in verse 3. Whether it's talking about that or whether it's meaning in a more limited context when he says here, I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, that the head of the woman is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. That may be what he means when he says, I want you to understand. In saying, I want you to understand a further application of this principle that whatever you do in word or deed ought to be done, or whatever you do ought to be done to the glory of God. It may be that that's what he means. But regardless of whether it's the limited context or the broader context, I want us to narrow it down still further and limit it principally this morning to just simply one verse, and that's the verse 3, where Paul says, I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of the woman is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Do you know what the issue at stake here is? The issue at stake is authority. The issue at stake is authority. That's what is meant by the word head. I think this is a universally understood term. There's no one, I suspect, in any language that would misunderstand that the word head means anything in this context except that of authority. Someone is head over someone else. Who is the head of this organization? Who is the head of this company? Take me to the head of this unit, or whatever it may be. It's always used in reference to someone who has authority over somebody else. Now, in this immediate context, in these 14 verses, from verse 3 through verse 16, the word head is used explicitly 11 times. It is also used implicitly. It is implied in elliptical sentences and in an elliptical construction where it's implied. It's used that way 7 times. 11 times explicitly, 7 times implicitly. And then in verse 10, the word veil or covering is actually the translation of the word exousia, which literally is authority. So you have about 19 times in 14 verses either the use of head explicitly or implicitly, or the use of the word authority being substituted or being translated as a covering over the head. This is undoubtedly the issue that is at stake at this particular juncture here in its immediate context. But not only is it the issue in this context, authority is the issue in life. I don't know whether you're aware of it or not, but we're living in a world that is arranged around the subject of authority. We're going to be appointing elders shortly. This is done because God has arranged elders in the congregation. This is this authority. It's within this authority chain that the eldership fits into God's plan. It was authority that was the subject at Eden, at the Garden of Eden, when Eve disobeyed God. The subject was authority. In Genesis 3 and 1, God had told them earlier, don't eat of this tree. In Genesis 3 and verse 1, Satan came and said, Eve, did God say that you should not eat of any tree of the garden? In other words, did he authoritatively tell you to do something or not to do something? She said, yes. He said, that tree right over there, we can eat of everything, but that one right over there. And he said, oh, Eve, you're not going to die if you eat that. So God had authoritatively said, do not eat that. Satan came along and undermined the authority of God. Eve ignored the authority of God and let Satan usurp the authority of God as she trampled underfoot the authority of God. The issue in the fall of man and woman was over the subject of authority. But not only in the fall there in the beginning of man's history, in every crisis where God was alienated or man was alienated from God, in every crisis where man walked away from God, it centered around this thing of authority. In 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 through 10, listen to this statement, and God uses the word especially down in verse 10, but listen to this train of thought. For if God did not spare the angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of the nether gloom or darkness, I'm going to wait till you turn to that if you'd like, 2 Peter 2, 4 through 10, he makes some statements here about authority that we must consider. For if God did not spare the angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of darkness to be kept until the judgment, if he did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, now here's another example of a catastrophe, a herald of righteousness with seven other persons whom he brought when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. And then a third example, if by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes, he condemned them to extinction and made them an example to those who were to be ungodly. And the fourth example, and if he rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the licentiousness of the wicked, then in verse 9 he draws this conclusion, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trial and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment. And especially, now notice this, especially those who indulge in the lust of defiling passion and despise authority. Now that's whom God is especially after. God is out to get, if you please. He is especially going to bring judgment against people who are indulging in defiling passion and who despise authority. Now look again at Jude, the 8th verse. He concurs with this, and it's almost a parallel passage. In verse 6, he begins by saying, and the angels that did not keep their own position but left their proper dwelling have been kept by him in eternal chains in the darkness until the judgment of the great day. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, which likewise acted immorally and indulged in unnatural lust, serve as an example by undergoing a punishment of eternal fire. Yet in like manner, these men in their dreamings defile the flesh, reject authority, and revile the glorious ones. Now, this is simply a statement that says that the eternal question of man's relationship to God centers around this subject of authority. And it can be boiled right on down to the little children in Ephesians, the 6th chapter and verse 1. The subject there and the issue at stake is whether or not children will recognize the authority of their parents. Because there, children are told, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. So this issue that really around which this whole subject of God's chain of command in the family centers is the subject of authority. And then there are some ramifications that are just multiple that we won't even begin to touch today. We've already mentioned some of them. Others of them are the male and female function and limitation in corporate worship, the dress and decorum of a woman, the conduct of the man, because of the angels, men wearing long hair, all of these things come under the purview of this subject of authority. And we may get to discuss it at some later time. But what is God's chain of authority, or his order of authority for the home? I want you to notice this chart, if you will. The chart actually has two parts. I had first thought we would get to both of them at one time, but we're not going to get it. I've decided yesterday we'd take this one today, and we'll take this side next Sunday. This particular side represents one part of this chain of authority. This represents the other part. This one represents the concept of those who are under authority. This side represents those who are in authority. And in any relationship where there is authority, there are those who are under authority, and there are those who are in authority. Now, the umbrella represents simply the protective care, the protective authority. It could be substituted with a hand, God's hand protecting Christ, Christ's hand protecting man, man's hand protecting woman and the children. Or, if you look at it from this point of view over here, the hand of God being that hand that's in authority, the hand of Christ being the hand of authority, the hand of man being the hand of authority, and the hand of woman under the say of the children, even under her. She's to rule her household. She is an authority. But I make this illustration, and I put the umbrella to represent people getting under the umbrella, that is, their being in subjection to it, and the umbrella being that which is over them. So there are people who are in who are under authority over here, and then there are those who are in authority. And I suspect that every human being, at some time or other, is both under authority and in authority. Now, whether you're ever in authority or not, you are under authority. And that's what we're going to be talking about this morning. First of all, we can't talk about authority without talking about submission or rebellion, one of the two. If you're a servant of Jesus Christ and you have committed yourself to be his disciple, you must talk about authority in terms of submission. That's why in talking about 1 Corinthians 11 and 3, where it says that Christ is the head of man, a man is the head of woman, and God is the head of Christ, we must talk about it in terms of submission, because that's what the issue is. What he is saying is, when he says that each of these is the head of the other, he's saying in converse that each of these is in submission to the one above him. Each person is in submission to the one who is his head. And when you talk about the order in the home, this is God's order for the home. I want you to understand, he says, that the head of every man is, that the head of every man is Christ. No, that the head of Christ, well, let me read it. That the head, I want to reverse the order, incidentally, and I reversed it to where I can't quote it. The head of every, I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of the woman is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. That's God's order for the family. And you can't talk about it without talking about submission. But secondly, in talking about this as the order in the family, you also talk about it as being the order in the church. Because in Ephesians, the 5th chapter, verses 25 through 33, Paul says that there is this same order in the church. And he draws this parallel and says that the same kind of authority-submission relationship that exists in the church, or that exists in the home, exists in the church. And then when you turn to Ephesians, the 1st chapter, and verses 22 and 23, you find that not only is this order of authority-submission true in the body of Christ, the church, not only is it true in the home, but it's true in the universe, because there it says that God has put all things in subjection under Christ and has given him to be head over all things. Ephesians talks about him being head over all principality and power. 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter, in verse 28, speaks of Jesus Christ as being that one under whose feet God has placed all things in subjection. And then eventually, he says, whenever all things have been placed in subjection under Christ, that Christ himself will be then placed in subjection once again to God, so that God might be all and in all. So we find that this subject of subjection and authority is a question, or is an issue, that runs from one end of life to the other. It runs through every ordered relationship between God and men. It exists in every institution where there is order and peace. It's just simply a total concept of God's arrangement for the universe. And I'll just simply sum it up, or not, with this one statement. Everybody is in subjection to somebody. And everybody, ideally, is in subjection to God. Everyone is under the authority of God. I'm going to notice these things in reverse now, and notice them as we hurriedly apply them to the family. First of all, he mentions last, the head of Christ is God. He mentions secondly, the head of the woman is the man. And thirdly, he mentions the head of man is Christ. First of all, though, let's notice the third one of these. The head of Christ is God. Can you notice, as you notice Jesus Christ, was he in subjection to his Father? Of course he was. In John 4, and about verse 34, he says, my meat is to do the will of him that sent me. In John 5:30, he says, I came not to do my will, but the will of him that sent me. In Luke 22 and verse 24, he prayed in the garden, Father, not my will, but thine be done. Everywhere he turned, in every activity, in every attitude, everything about him said, I'm doing the will of my Father, not my own will. And from the very time that he was born until he gave up his life on the cross, everything about Jesus Christ was in submission to his Father. In fact, in Hebrews, the 10th chapter, the writer there says in verse 5 and 7, that when Christ came into the world, he said, I have come to do thy will, O God. That was that which the Hebrew writer used to sum up the entire life of Jesus Christ. It was one in subjection to God. All right? We understand that. I don't think anyone questions it, that Jesus Christ is subject to God. Paul says here that God is the head of Christ. All right, look at the second thing that's mentioned, that the husband is the head of the wife. He mentions it in the other way of saying it, that the head of a woman is her husband. Now, this is God's arrangement in the home. I don't know whether you as a wife, I don't know how a wife responds to this. I don't know whether you accept it joyfully or accept it grudgingly. I don't know whether you even accept it. Perhaps some women don't. But this is the arrangement that God has made. This is true and necessary by order of the creation. Paul says here, man was not made from woman, but woman was made from man. He's referring here to the creation. And he says, neither was man made for woman, but woman was made for the man. This is talking again about creation. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, the Apostle Paul talks about this same thing of creation, and he says that Adam was first formed and then Eve. So by the order of creation, man was made first and woman was made second. Now, before you get all puffed up, you men, recognize that the monkey was also made before man was made. And so was the cat and the dog. And it may mean that the last thing that he created is the finest thing that he created. And I suspect that's about right. He made man first, yes. But in so many ways, when he made woman after he made man, he may have corrected all the problems that he had in man and made another model. And I say that somewhat facetiously, but don't get puffed up just because you were created first. For some reason or other, though, God uses it as a reason for saying that man is to be the authority in the home. But secondly, not just in order of the creation, in terms of the fall. Paul says it was not Adam that was deceived, but it was Eve. She was deceived and she fell into transgression. He talks about the fall and the result of the fall being that the desire of the woman would be to her husband and that the husband would rule over the wife. Now, this is part of the result of the fall. But whenever it speaks of her being deceived, it speaks of her temperament. And I'm going to make some statements here that I believe you'll agree with. As far as her temperament is concerned, women are more sympathetic, tender-hearted, emotional, and insecure than men are. Generally speaking, they are not as aggressive or dominant by choice. They do not function in an aggressive, dominant role comfortably. Sometimes they're forced to, but this is not their role by their makeup or by choice. It usually is forced upon them. A woman looks for and needs the security and the protection of a husband who is functioning responsibly as the head of that woman, as the head of the house. That's why in Ephesians, the 5th chapter, verses 22 through 24, the writer makes this statement and binds this order upon the wife. Wives, be subject to your husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. As the church is subject to Christ, so let wives also be subject in everything to their husbands. That's God's arrangement. I didn't arrange it like that. God arranged it like that. Your husband didn't arrange it like that. God arranged it like that. God is the head of Christ, but then he says that the man is the head of the woman. But then notice something else. From just a surface perusal of that arrangement there, it looks pretty good for us men. It looks like a pretty fair perch. Here we are sitting upon this perch overlooking the whole realm. And that perch so many times is the chair in front of the TV. And from that chair we issue edicts and we issue orders and we expect the wife to jump, and we sometimes treat them, with inconsiderate action and all of this. It looks pretty good. And from this perch, some men have taken the unwarranted liberty of saying, I'm the head of this house, and you're going to do like I say because I'm the head of this house. I'm ruling this roost. I'm wearing the breeches in this family, and you're going to do like I say. And he tells his wife that, and he tells his children that, and he goes on his merry, selfish, self-centered way and demands subjection by his wife and children, even though he doesn't deserve it. Well, a reaction has set in on that kind of an attitude, and it's the women's liberation movement. And the women's liberation movement says who? You say that you're the one that has the rule in the house, says who? I'm just as important as you are. I've got just as much say-so as you've got, and we'll just see who has the head and who has the authority in the house. So the women's liberation movement has come about as a reaction to it. But there's a third link in this chain that I want to mention today as we talk about people who are under authority. Christ was under authority. You women who are wives are under authority. But there's a third link in the chain, and that is those of us who are men and husbands, we also are under authority. And the third link is this, that every man, the head of every man is Christ. The head of every man is Christ. The divine authority vested in the husband and father is that which is patterned after Jesus Christ's own authority. And Jesus Christ's authority was predicated upon his submission to his father. Only when he recognized and respected his authority over him, only then did he claim authority over others. He came to do his father's will and then had the right to say, now, I want you to do my will. It was only after Jesus Christ had gone to the cross and had yielded himself totally in submission to God's authority, only after he had said, not my will, Father, but yours be done, it was only after that he came to the disciples and had the right to say to them, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. He did not come to them at the beginning of the personal ministry and make that claim. It was only after he had gone to the cross and had surrendered himself to his authority that he came and said, now, all authority has been given to me, you go. And if you men are having trouble with your wives and with your children, and if you cannot find that they are being in subjection to you, if you see that they're rebelling against your authority and they don't listen to what you say and they don't respect you as the head of the house, I suspect you ought to take some inventory. I suspect we ought to ask ourselves the question, why is it that my wife and children do not respect my authority? And you know where the blame may very well lie? It may very well lie in the fact that they see in you a man who is rebelling against his head, Jesus Christ. That either openly or secretly, you are living a life of rebellion against God. And if once they see that you are not under your authority, they don't want to be under your authority. And once they've found out that you're in rebellion against your head, you need not expect them to be at least very kindly in subjection to you as a head. And a statement was made in a book entitled Marriage in the Home as God Would Have It by my brother Dan. This is a statement that I thought was so good. Only those who live under authority are fit to wield authority. Only those who live under authority are fit to wield authority. And I say amen to that. And the day when your wife and your children see that you are in subjection to the authority of Jesus Christ under God, that day they'll begin to respect the authority that you have over them as the head of your home. Brethren and sisters, the arrangement that God has made in his family, in the home, in the domestic realm, is that there is to be a chain of authority. God is over Christ, Christ is over the man is over the wife, and over then the children. And that's God's arrangement. And any disregard for that arrangement spells trouble. An overbearing, headstrong, domineering wife is a disgrace to her husband and is actually a danger to her children. I want to say that again. An overbearing, headstrong, domineering wife is a disgrace to her husband and a danger to her children. Likewise, a ruthless dictator or a spineless jellyfish of a husband is likewise a disgrace to his God and an affront to his wife and a danger to his children. And until we can find ourselves ordering ourselves under God's arrangement, you cannot expect anything but trouble. And I could show you the ramifications, but we won't have the time today. But may I urge you to recognize that everybody is under authority to somebody. You children, you're under the authority of your mother and father in the Lord. You wives, you're under the authority of your husband. You husbands, you're under the authority of Christ. Christ is under the authority of God. And when we get back to that order, then we'll get back to peace and harmony. And this is the arrangement that God has made for the church. May God bless us as we continue to study these things. Next Sunday, we're going to see the responsibility that rests upon those people who are in authority. The responsibility of those who are under authority, the responsibility is submission. And we'll notice the responsibility that goes with the other side of that next Sunday. As we talk about authority, obviously we're talking about the authority of Jesus Christ. We've had a meeting this past week that was directed to those who are not Christians primarily. And there may be some of you here today as a holdover from the meeting that never have surrendered to the authority of Christ. I would like to extend the invitation to you. You've heard a week's preaching on the authority of Jesus Christ and on your responsibility to surrender to Him. How that you should come in faith, turning your back upon sin, quit your rebellion, surrender to His authority, be buried with Him in baptism, be raised to walk a new life. There may be some of you who would like to use this opportunity to do that. And we extend that invitation to you. Those of you who are husbands and wives, will you recognize the authority that you're under as we all surrender to the authority of Jesus Christ? May God bless us. I wish for you the joy that's in Jesus Christ by surrendering to His authority. Would you come while we stand and sing?